me a secret. I don't just want to know about any secret.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. It means Fridays with Sandy Williams. Let's go to the phone lines and David from Mecklen. Hey, David, thanks for hanging on. You say what?
Hey, good morning. Really quickly, I just want to remind everybody that since 1960, the U.S. government has raised the debt ceiling 78 times. And it will be raised again. I'm very confident of that. And part of the problem, though, is, you know, since we've done this now 78 times, this will be the 79th time since 1960, is that we as Americans are not understanding the fact that when you have the Federal Reserve pumping out the money that they're doing, there's consequences with that. And you see with, you know, essentially, it's not just the United States problem. This is a worldwide problem. One thing I was very surprised with you, Sandy, and I mentioned it to Earl off the air like a week ago. You know, Turkey had an inflation rate in 2022, and you said you didn't really see any poverty. But the inflation rate in Turkey is 84%.
No, I know.
That's what it was confirmed for 2022.
Yeah.
2023, it's down to like 40-some-odd percent. The point being that, you know, everyone looks at what's going on with us, but this is a world problem where countries do not have their finances together at all. And consequently, it's creating inflation, whether we buy products from overseas, whether we put here, and obviously you know about the tariffs, where being obviously that's paid by consumers. We have, this is all to blame on governments around the world, not just us. And, you know, I just want to keep people just in sync here just for a little bit, because at the end of the day, something will be negotiated. Nobody's going to be very happy with it. And at the end of the day, we do have to figure out, okay, what are we going to do going forward? Because to the previous caller's point, now that we've raised interest rates considerably to try to stamp out inflation, that is increasing our interest on the debt substantially. So even, you know, when you were just speaking about, you know, with the whole debt ceiling crisis, this is been a ball rolling for quite a while. And keep in mind, we just raised the debt ceiling under Schumer and McConnell back in 2021 when Democrats had a control. They raised it by $2.5 trillion, if I recall, at that time. And here we are, you know, a little over a year later, and we're talking about another 1.5, maybe possibly a little higher increase in the debt ceiling. So there's definitely, there's a lot of money flowing out. We're just not realizing that it's not just us, and it's, this is a global situation.
Well, clearly there is, you know, most nations in the world now are operating on deficits, so that I think Germany is one of the few countries that doesn't operate regularly on a deficit. And, you know, that has, from an one standpoint, has the potential to be inflationary. You know, the inflationary situation we've had for the last couple of years seemed to be circumstantial and not necessarily the result of the echo effect of the deficits and also the monetary policy, particularly the policy of repurchasing government instruments and putting money into the economy that way through the Federal Reserve. But, you know, the economists are confused about the extent to which operating with deficits, what level of deficit is permissible, and typically they've compared it to the GDP of the country having the deficit to try and figure out what level of debt and what level of annual deficit is sustainable without being inflationary. And the United States has tended to be on the lower side of that, but lately we've been trending in the wrong direction. And so I would agree with you, Dave, that I do think fiscal discipline is going to be have to be imposed by this government, by both parties, and that fiscal discipline needs to be reflected on the revenue side as well. Having tax reductions during a period of a hot economy was a terribly irresponsible move that, that increased the deficit just as much as we've increased it through our efforts to stimulate the economy with deficits.
And so clearly the economy had to be stimulated at the time that it was being
well, not the tax reduction under Trump.
We were already in a position of prosperity. I'm talking about COVID.
Yes.
And at that point in time, David, because you know that's kind of what you're alluding to, the fact that that was unnecessary, but all agreed it had to happen. Then.
Well, the Stimulus Act. You know, you look around at all the highway programs ongoing now, and you might shake your head and say, "Gee, maybe that Stimulus Act was you know we're doing too much at once." Because it has definitely created a job, a labor shortage in certain industries based on the huge amount of ongoing infrastructure work that's all happening simultaneously. So, you know, it's a little bit like instead of turning on the faucet, we turned on the fire hose, and that might have been an overreaction.
You know, Sandy, there's no question that the infrastructure stuff had been you know, just not even looked at for far too many decades. You're not going to fix it all inside of one decade. But clearly, people have been clamoring for the infrastructure.
Well interestingly, if you look at the bursts of infrastructure construction in our country, one of the first bursts after the railroad was expanded based on a whole bunch of different policies was the Works Public Administration and the Depression, when that was basically government stimulus. Then we had the post-World War II economy, which was uniquely prosperous and capable of raising tax revenue very rapidly, in which we built our highway system and destroyed, at the same time, our intra-urban rail system and neglected our train system. And then we let everything slide for 40 years. So we're now in a period of deferred maintenance and bearing the expense like businesses do of catching up on deferred maintenance. My belief, however, is that the infrastructure bill has the qualities of a pork barrel for political purposes. And when you open the pork barrel, you might find that it gets a little bit expansive. And so I think one of the reasons I believe that Biden is probably negotiating now is the capacity to scale back the expenditures that were created during the stimulus period because some of those expenditures, first of all, haven't even been made yet, and second of all, might be at an excessive rate.
Excuse me. And part of that, and some of the things I've been reading, those are part of the things he is willing
right
to scale back.
Yeah.
Let's move to Sandy, to Stuart Rhodes. A character that if you hear the name Stuart Rhodes, and just seems like the average guy.
Sounds like you should be a lawyer on Wall Street.
Stuart Rhodes, and it's an ordinary guy. But Stuart Rhodes was sentenced to 18 years in prison.
Yeah.
For those of you who may not know the name, he was the head guy of the Oath Keepers. And if you don't know who the Oath Keepers are, they're this group of folk who kind of organize the troops that attack, you know, the Capitol, even though, never mind what some of the people say, this peaceful gathering.
Well, clearly a jury was convinced that Stuart Rhodes played a role that met the standards of seditious conspiracy, which was the law that he was charged with violating.
So, Sandy, for those of us who don't know what seditious conspiracy is, give us a quick little...
Well, sedition is essentially an act to try and impede or overthrow the government. And the
very serious allegations, right?
Very serious allegation. Now, it dates back to a period when it might have been misused. During World War I, there were some sedition acts that were enacted that basically even limited speech against the war effort in World War I. But this law is designed to, to affect, to create criminality for someone who actually purposefully tries to either overthrow the government or impede its operations. And conspiracy is just the process of participating with several people in this effort.
Right.
And so he was convicted of, and basically the jury apparently was persuaded that he was the leader of a conspiracy in which people were talking about and then implementing a plan to interfere with the transfer of power on January 6th.
He got 18 years. That's a long
time. It is a long time. And I was a little surprised by the duration, and I was afraid that the duration gives merit to, or at least would give some weight to those who would say, see, this is a political, this is a
witch hunt.
Political witch hunt. Look at what they did to him. But, you know, juries don't, and courts tend to be pretty neutral bodies, quite frankly. And this isn't like Congress doing this. This is a court of law that heard a bunch of evidence, saw a bunch of evidence in terms of videos, et cetera, heard testimony, and decided that this guy apparently was very willfully designing and plotting to cause a situation that would impede the operation of the government.
So hold the thought, Sandy. In layman's terms, you know, hollering fire in a movie theater, right?
Yeah.
I mean, let's go to break. 844-967-2789. We'll be back. So, Sandy. Us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. It means Fridays with Sandy Williams. The Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes sentenced to 18 years in prison for the January 6th Capitol attack. And Sandy, we were saying off the air, I was asking you questions about a lot of us saw this, excuse me, and we believed that this was a no-brainer. And we were wondering why they hadn't moved on these people yet. And I was saying to you, the system worked.
Well, I think it does. You know, the wheels of justice move rather slowly. And you know, when you're a defendant in a criminal case, you want to make sure that you pull out all the stops, that you get it, that you pose all the defenses you can. these people were given all those opportunities, and I think the deliberate pursuit of these cases helps the American system prove that it works, because you know it wasn't a rush to judgment. They weren't, you know, like they could be in some country, put before a firing squad 2 days later. You know, there was actual investigation. There were defenses raised, all of the defenses raised. There will be appeals from this. You know, our legal system has flaws, but it is by far, I think, one of the best in terms of the application of the rule of law. We do that. And it's important that we do that. And it was important we do that in this case, because there clearly was an effort to overthrow the results of this election. People could say, well, it was just a demonstration. But clearly, this jury, this judge, and others as well, were persuaded that this was more than that, that this was an effort at essentially a coup. It was an effort to disrupt the operation of government and to cause the transfer of power not to occur as it was constitutionally established and should have occurred, and it did occur. But we can all recall exactly the terror that was ongoing. You know, the vice president in fear of his life, gallows out. You know, with an effigy of the vice president hanging. I mean, this was a serious matter, and so I think this court has established that fact.
So you'll hear people say, well, 18 years is a long time, and there are people who get shorter sentences for things that people will say are probably worse. But Sandy, it is clear, and when you brought up, because I had forgotten about it, the fact that the people were threatening to hang, and we don't know what they would have done had they gotten their hands on people.
Well,
right?
Yes, and I think part of, you know, the attorney for Rhodes is now on the radio saying that he's going to appeal, and this is all about freedom of speech. But my understanding of the evidence was that it went to a whole bunch of emails and other kinds of correspondence that was conducted by Rhodes, coordinating the activities of people and discussing essentially the objectives. And so, you know, in America, when juries act, we believe them. It's a jury of our peers. When courts act, that's the process. You know, 18 years is a long time, but that's the outcome that people who were very privy and knowledgeable about the facts decided was the appropriate outcome.
So isn't part of this to send a serious message to anybody else who might want to consider doing what took place here?
Yeah, although, you know, deterrence isn't what courts and juries are about. So I think this was just about this case, but it does obviously, hopefully, send a serious message that it isn't just for fun. This fellow who was putting his feet up on the desk.
Yeah, he got 4.5 years.
Got 4.5 years. I mean, I think people will now realize that government processes are not to be tinkered with in a manner that's designed to subvert them. And I think that our ex-president played a role in creating an atmosphere where people thought that this was potentially just an outing for an afternoon, exercising their political will and not putting themselves at risk. But the conduct itself that day was quite different. It was a mob, okay? And mobs can develop a whole approach on their own. This mob got itself in a lot of trouble.
All right, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. We'll be right back.
She owes you sweetest of debts. She wants and the lyrics. Start.
All I ask is why. If you're playing, all I'm saying is feeling sure alive. If you're lying, keep on lying. Don't tell the truth, don't you dare.
Don't you dare.
At 844-967-2789. It's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, man, the more we delve into international things that are going on, the more you kind of realize, man, the world has really changed. And things that, you know, we Americans didn't pay any attention to for decades because we were so comfortable. We were always going to be, everybody's going to want to be us. Hey, there's some things have changed. And well, we as Americans don't even know they've changed.
Well, you know, I think some things haven't changed, but the implication of them has changed. So that, for instance, the nations that have nuclear weapons, you know, Americans couldn't list them all, I'm sure.
Right.
But they were asleep. You know, nuclear weapons, other than the fear that they would get in the hands of terrorists, basically has been an issue that's been asleep, other than us not wanting Iran or North Korea to get nuclear
right.
weapons. But the issue has become much more fraught now because when here in the world, when we have countries at war with one another, when we have proxy fights ongoing, proxy wars ongoing that involve the United States on the one side and Russia on the other, or potentially China on the other with respect to Taiwan, we end up experiencing a situation in which when you get into a war and there is disproportionate power between, let's say, if the United States actually got into a direct war with someone, we now realize, based on Ukraine, that if we got into a direct war with Russia, we would overwhelm them militarily, except for one thing. They have a bigger nuclear arsenal than we do.
Right.
And so the nuclear weapons are the great equalizer. They're the six guns in the West. You know, Billy the Kid was a little guy, but he was equal to everyone else because he had a six gun. And so we now realize that all these nuclear weapons sitting in the hands of various countries are the equalizers that permit them to stand up to, for instance, us. And so if you're a country that doesn't have a nuclear weapon, like Iran, it suddenly maybe becomes imperative that you have one so that the United States deals with you more carefully than we might otherwise deal with them. And so that motivates them to have the nuclear weapon. But the other thing that's ongoing now is that China is actively reaching out, forming alliances. China is operating under the principle of realpolitik that I was describing for Kissinger early. They aren't worried about what's going on inside each country. They're interested in dealing with each country on a pragmatic basis. You know, what's good for China, what's good for the world generally. And so, you know, they're busily building a bridge to Saudi Arabia. They're helping Saudi Arabia build a bridge to Iran. People wouldn't have imagined that. Saudi Arabia and Iran used to be like oil and water. But the two of them are clearly on the verge of if not kumbaya, at least having a peaceful relation. And, of course, that makes a big difference to Iran. Iran's been locked out of the oil market for quite a while by the sanctions from the United States. They've got huge oil reserves. They'd like nothing more than to get those back, actively involved. China would like nothing more than to increase the supply of oil from which they can bargain to buy their oil. So, you know, that this Eurasian kind of an alliance that was talked about and has been talked about, that Putin has been pushing, is actually coming to fruition.
So from the perspective of America, and why are these things, not even the fact that nuclear weapons exist, but we're more concerned that China is in a position to negotiate with these other nations because they don't have sanctions and military bases and all of the, all of that baggage, to right. be honest with you, that we have. And other nations are willing to negotiate commerce with.
Well, China's a huge customer of oil, so that gives them more leverage in the Mideast than the United States. We're a competitor. We're one of the largest producers of oil. So our ability to actually lean on the Mideast with respect to their oil policies.
As we used to be able to do.
Yeah, we used to be able to do that. You know, the petrodollar that back in the 70s, Kissinger was able to negotiate a process with OPEC in which OPEC agreed that all oil sales would be carried out in dollars denominated. Well, China's kind of actively trying to readdress that. And I think their oil transactions are going to be carried out in yuan, the Chinese currency. And so all of this process begins to threaten the United States dominance and ultimately the dominance of the world dollar. I mean, I know that Warren Buffett and others have said, oh, don't worry about the world dollar. It would take so many circumstances to topple it from the dollar being the world currency. But a lot of those circumstances are coming into play. And furthermore, what's going on in Washington right now plays right into those hands.
You know, Sandy, you know, maybe people may say, you know, you guys are always trying to ring a bell that the United States is, you know, we're headed towards disaster. The United States is, you know, a negative influence in the world. You know, why do you keep saying those things? And Sandy, we're not saying, we're only saying to the American people, open your eyes, right?
Right.
I mean, just be vigilant and just maybe read some things, not because Sandy and I are saying it. We're kind of like giving people, warning people.
Well, I've talked about this, but there's an article 10, 15 years ago called Zero to 60 in a Decade, and it was about General Motors and Toyota. And it was comparing the corporate cultures. And General Motors, if you came forward with bad news, you were relegated to the back bench, and so people were cheerleaders. They didn't bring forward to management the troubles that GM had that they needed to solve. At Toyota, they celebrated people coming forward and saying, here's a problem, we can solve it. They celebrated because, God, we can solve a problem. We're going to get better.
Right.
You're making us better. And Toyota leapt forward to the point that, you know, within 10 years, they went from a Japanese car no one wanted to the car that J.D. Powers ranked the highest quality car. And
statistical process control.
Yeah. And so I'm simply saying that our national culture ought to get more like Toyota, and we ought to be looking at ourselves critically so that we can get better. Because if we don't look critically at ourselves, we can be fat and happy until it's too late.
You know, Sandy, this is something even different than that conversation. And I was the other day, I was talking about the fact that there's so many medications that we're short of in this country because we don't have what is necessary in this country to produce the medications that are some of them life-changing and life-saving for the American people. We have to get them from different nations. And we're having trouble working these things out. Why is it so difficult, Sandy, for a nation like ours that, you know, has all these capabilities of the greatest weapons ever known to man, but we can't seem to find what we need to extend the lives of the American citizens? They're in different countries. Well, we can make this stuff happen.
I think a lot of those things are the low profit margin, non-patented medications, literally.
Yes. So the
big pharma wants to focus on the high profit items, but if the, when the patent's worn out and it's all generic, then it, they get made in India. You know,
yeah,
because they're shaving costs to try and compete in the generic market. So, you know, India is one of the primary manufacturers of drugs offshore of the United States.
So those generic drugs, they're not the real thing, right?
Well, they're the real thing. It's just that they don't have a brand. You know, the generic drug, by generic, it simply means that it's an unbranded drug that is that has the same efficacy as the branded drug, but you can buy it with a generic title and much cheaper.
So you're paying for the name.
Essentially, you're paying for the name.
There
might be some very minor differences in the makeup of the drug, but you're basically paying for the Rolex watch rather than the Timex watch.
But Sandy, you're reading about the cancer medications that people need. We're short on those things in this country. We can't seem to get them from these different countries. And my thing, Sandy, is that's unacceptable. Our nation has the capacity to do it. Why is it not prioritized?
Well, I mean, the problem is, you know, and like I said on one of the earlier shows, we don't have plans. We don't have and we shouldn't, actually. I mean, it's very hard to have a five-year plan. I mean, China doesn't even have them now, but they used to laugh at the five-year central planning of China. But they do have a planning process in their government to try and figure out where they'll invest money and where the government will invest to stimulate private enterprise there. And we don't have that. And so we rely totally on a market mechanism, but we have a flawed market mechanism because things like patents disrupt competition. There is no competition when there's a patent. It's a monopoly. And so our system of capitalism, particularly in the medical field, is not at all a pure market mechanism, and it's very flawed, and we're suffering the consequences of the imperfection of that market. And the imperfections are basically caused by government interventions.
So as simple as you can, which might be a little difficult, explain to us, those of us not in the know, why this market-driven society is lagging when it comes to the people. What maybe there was a time when that wasn't the case, Sandy, but it seems to be a difficult thing to overcome.
Well, it has to do with the fact that we don't really have a proper market mechanism in the medical field, for sure. You know, it's filled with government kinds of imperfections. Now, it would be better if it was entirely a government process, but instead we've introduced the government into various elements of it. We grant patents for medicines that are could be very important and curative, but by granting a patent, we give a monopoly to one manufacturer. Now that manufacturer can charge what, you know, they can charge whatever. And if it's a life-saving medication that's extremely important, they can charge a very high price because the government is the provider of, under Medicaid, for instance, the government will pay for it. And so There isn't a market throttle on the other side of the coin to throttle down the price of these monopoly drugs.
So if the taxpayers' money helps them develop some of those things, how come we can't control it then? Because they wouldn't be able to
Bingo, that's another problem. I mean, you know, for the patents, we aren't regulating the price of patented things. We as the United States have a unique process for patenting drugs, which is why you can buy drugs cheaper in Canada or in other countries than you can here.
We've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. We'll be right back.
Unexpected. Upper 70s, Sunday, turning warmer.
You can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy. With Sandy, it's why I have enjoyed you and the conversations, because you know how to drill down on these things that are happening that impact and affect us in this country that we don't even know are happening. And a lot of times that these things are happening well beyond our pay grades. We just know these things are happening. We don't know why. We think we know the inner workings of our government, but we really don't. And so it impacts all of our lives, and our lives are changing. And at some point in time, I don't know, Sandy, is if let's say all of us understood the things you understand, whether or not that would change anything with the way things are configured in this government.
For the better or worse?
For the better. We need it for the better, man.
Yeah, well, you know, my concern is, and I think Tom from L.A. is right about this, that money in politics and the related lobbying, the K Street, the influence of K Street, which is really just a euphemism for describing the people in Washington who are representing special interests and causing the legislators in Washington to respond not to the broad public interest, but to each special interest looked at one at a time. And the problem with that is the composite of that doesn't end up meeting the public's interest. It ends up creating laws that splinter our processes. And the healthcare industry is a prime example. The government has tinkered with it in so many ways that it doesn't fix it. It just breaks it. It breaks it more and more so that the incentives built into the medical system are not beneficial to the public. They end up being beneficial to big pharma or to medical equipment suppliers or to hospitals or to health insurers or to a variety of the special interests that have muscle. But the composite result of that is not making medical costs cheaper for us. It's not making it particularly more available to us. You know, Obamacare started out with the initial premise could have been, and back in the day was, Medicare for all, but that couldn't overcome the power of the health insurance industry. So now we had to have private health insurance. So then it began to look like the Massachusetts program that Mitt Romney installed, which was the Obamacare model. But now we have a system where, because we don't have a mandate that everyone has to have insurance, we end up with the problem of insurance being quite expensive. So bronze care, you know, is beyond reach.
Here's one of the reasons why this is such an important topic and discussion is the average American is now 39 years old. The American age rapidly in the last decade as baby boomers grew older and births dropped. Births are dropping. The American people are getting older, which means they're going to require more health care, more medical coverage, And it's not going to turn around tomorrow, Sandy. This is a trend that we're on. Is it safe to say that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and it's a trend that we're seeing and we're feeling the impact of right now. And, of course, Medicare is funded much like Social Security so that it's got the same kind of implications for becoming underfunded. And so we need to get our arms around the cost of medical care in this country. I think the number is like 17 or 18% of our GDP is devoted to medical care of various kinds. I mean, that is in a very unhealthy slice of the gross domestic product of the United States.
So this trend, as well as China's trend, they're experiencing the exact same thing, the aging of their population. You understand more from the China perspective because they used to just say one birth per family. And that, you know, and that finally, I guess, is catching up with them. But that wasn't the case. They were mandated in China, right? And I don't think it's that way anymore.
But no, in fact, quite the contrary. I think they're trying to create more incentives in the direction of having more children. But it's a hard trend to turn around when the culture has gotten very used to the notion of having one child in a family.
And so the fact that we are graying literally as a nation, and all of these things that you are piling on top of one another is clearly has to impact our nation's ability in the long run, right?
To be honest with you, I think it's a little bit like the kid whose room is filled with clothing, you know, piled up. It's a mess. and he just shuts the door and hopes that mom doesn't look in and chew him out and make him do it. So
I love your analogies, by the way.
I think as an American public, we're closing the door on that messy bedroom and we're worried about other things. You know, that's what's caused us to focus on so many shiny objects, to spend all this time on the LGBT, you know, the issues that do matter to people, but they are not fundamental to our society in terms of curing what ails us economically and sociologically. I mean, what we should be having is we should be able to just have tolerance. Ignore that issue. It shouldn't even be taking up all our time. We ought to be in our bedroom cleaning up the mess.
Yeah, and the LGBTQ is something that we can stay on for a moment, but not long term. And this is still there.
Well, I think all we should say about it is let's all just mind our own business. Let's be tolerant and let's love fellow man and, you know, move on. We can't seem to get there.
I think a gentleman who... you know, we don't talk about it anymore. Said it best. Can't we all just get along?
Yeah.
All right. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. We'll be right back.